Welcome to week three. I'm just going to mute everybody by default, and you'll be able to unmute for questions and comments, but I'm going to take the opportunity of muting everybody just to remind those or let people know, for those who weren't there when we said it before, this is a no-election zone. We're going to spend an hour studying, learning, talking, questioning, answering, that's it. So we are up to the topic of compulsion for vaccination, and then if we have time, we'll also start on the issue of vaccine trials. I'd like us to be able next week to complete vaccine trials as well as to talk at least a little bit about vaccine distribution. So our main focus though this week is the issue of compelling somebody to take a vaccine. People got the sheets. They got the email and hopefully were able to download it. I know some people have been dealing with that spinning circle of doom when they try to download it. There is a solution though, which is you should have, when you click on that link to download it here, they should have an option in the top right part of your screen, an arrow, a down arrow, and you click that and then you're able to download it. Something along those lines. Your operating system may vary, but I hope people have it. If someone doesn't, just send me a message in the chat, let me know. I can upload it let me just upload it by default to the chat now. The problem is always that those who then join don't see what I already uploaded.
It was very easy.
Okay. Marilyn says it was very easy. Thank you. We have Marilyn's seal of approval.
Listen, I'm a complex. It was very easy.
Yeah, you got it. Okay, well, I just put it in the chat. Okay, so the session today is dedicated with the following gifts from the Day of Giving we held back in July. Charlie and Natalie Pifko, TK and Yossi Rosenblum, and Dan and Karen Valter. Okay. So, do we compel people to vaccinate? And again, as we said the first 2 weeks, no vaccine, and not just COVID, but for diseases in general, vaccines are not 100% in terms of their effectiveness. And there are always risks. Not necessarily the high levels of risk that certain groups are warning about, but there is some level of risk with every medical intervention. So the question is, must a person take risks for the sake of the community, even if they don't feel the risk is justified for their own health and for their own protection, right? If you have somebody who says that, for myself, I don't need it, will they still be obligated to take the vaccine on behalf of everybody else? That's our opening question, which we noted at the end last time, and I referred you to a source, which is source number one on your source sheet from the Government of Canada. Is immunization mandatory in Canada? In which we say immunizations are not mandatory in Canada. However, in Ontario and New Brunswick, proof of immunization is required for children and adolescents to attend school. In these same provinces, exceptions to immunizations can be made only for medical or ideological reasons. So, two provinces, including our own Ontario, which say that you have to be able to go to school, you have to be able to show you were immunized, unless you're not. Right? Unless you have a medical excuse, unless you have an ideological objection. And in the event of outbreaks, kids who are not immunized, even legitimately, may be asked to stay home from school, childcare, or other organized activities until the outbreak is over. Okay. I just realized I didn't start the recording on the video, so I'm starting that now. There it goes. Okay. Good. Now we've got that. Now we have the video running as well. That's our opening point. The government in general is not willing to compel vaccination. Even in the most extreme provinces, they're not willing to compel vaccination. So my question to you is, why? Why is it that the government will not say, if they believe the science, they believe it enough to support it and fund it, why is it that the government will not compel?
They won't get in again. I think they're afraid of their constituents.
So Susan suggests the concern is popular support and the fact that they're going to have to run for office again. And again, we're not saying the E word. That was very good, Susan, the way you avoided that. But concern that they need to be able to get into office. You can make that argument. I would suggest, along the same lines, but on a more philosophical level, society, Western society at this point, and certainly Canadian society, focuses on the rights of individuals and prioritizes that over responsibility to others. This is a society that, even though, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, even though Canadians have a strong sense of civic character and a strong sense of loyalty to the community, nonetheless, pitting individual rights against communal responsibilities, the bias is towards individual rights. What about in Judaism? So I want to look at this from two different perspectives. First, I'm going to look at it from the government's perspective. Is it right for government to compel people to take a risk? And then I want to turn it around and ask it from the patient's perspective. Even if the government is not able to compel you, from a Jewish perspective, does an individual have an obligation to say, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to take that risk that I don't think I need for myself, but I will for the sake of the community. Clear? That's the idea. So let's start with the government's perspective. From, again, within Judaism, is it right to compel people to take a risk? Let's say the risk for a particular side effect, heart problems, respiratory issues, depression, whatever it is. Let's say the side effect is one in a million. So I could make the argument that if the side effect is only one in a million, people, generally speaking, take risks like that, and they don't particularly care. And therefore, we've already said that risks that are negligible are things that people are allowed to take. Maybe halacha would ignore, Jewish law would ignore a risk of that level. The problem is, from the government's perspective, if we are going to compel vaccination, we're going to have 30 to 40 million people vaccinated, right? I forget what the exact number is at this point. And you're excluding, you know, certain populations, whatever, youngest children and so on. Nonetheless, you're sentencing 30 to 40 people to that side effect by compelling vaccination, whatever that side effect may be. So is that okay in the name of helping the community? What would Jewish law say? I turn the question to you, but not just to say I feel like, but give me a source, give me a basis for saying that Judaism will say one way or the other in terms of forcing people to take that that risk. Yes, Susan.
I think from the point of view of pikuach nefesh, and like we're allowed to, if you're in a I go back to the desert thing. If you're in a desert and you only have enough water for one for yourself, and that there's another person, halacha says you save yourself rather than both of you die. And that's like, so it's allowing, when there's an emergency, the risk that somebody, you're allowed to let somebody else die to save yourself. And in the sense of communal, if you take that and multiply it by the whole group, yes, some people may get sick or may get a side effect, but to save the majority, then I think it should be allowed.
So that's an interesting source to bring, because you could turn that source in a lot of different directions. Susan points out there is a passage in the Talmud in which we discuss the hypothetical case in which somebody needs a drink of water that they currently have. They're holding the water themselves, and they're traveling with somebody else. And in the event that both drink, they both will die. But if they drink personally, they will survive. And the conclusion there seems to be that you keep the water for yourself. So what Susan seems to be saying, and Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, is you're putting the community in the position of being the one holding the water.
Yes.
What's the difference, though, between the community in our discussion and the person holding the water in that passage in the Talmud?
Well, in the Talmud, it is life and death. At that point, right?
Not just that. You're right, but not just that. What in terms of the actual, you know, the story and the act the community would be doing.
I'm not sure I know what you're
referring to. The community.
So the difference, the difference between the Talmudic case you're bringing and this discussion is that what the Talmud allows you to do is drink the water that you are holding, knowing that somebody else will suffer as a result.
Right.
Here, you're talking about the community making somebody else harm themselves, take a risk for themselves.
Oh, okay.
Right? The analogy really would be, if the other guy in the desert has the water, and I'm going to punch him in the face and take the water.
That's wrong.
So yeah, we don't allow that. That's not a good thing. Please don't do that. So yeah, Dr. Kirshen has a note in the chat where he points out Guillain-Barré syndrome, as a strong side effect during swine flu in 1977. And he also notes the question of, well, whose blood is more red, community versus individual, as a possible argument. And we'll have to come back to an idea similar to that. But the question fundamentally is this. Can you get other people to take a risk in order to benefit you, in order to benefit the community? Okay. Yes.
Isn't there the situation where the community is under siege and the enemy says, hand over Torchino or we'll kill everybody?
Right. So there is such a... There is such a discussion. I'm going to come back to that. Mark points out there's a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud which speaks about a caravan that is surrounded by bandits, and the bandits say, turn over one of you or we kill everybody. And we're going to come back to that case because I think that is potentially a useful parallel. So as a general rule, I think you can argue that Jewish law might justify compelling the vaccine for the sake of the community. Number one, generally speaking, you are able to expose somebody to minimal harm in order to produce a benefit for them. You're able to expose someone to minimal harm in order to benefit them. And here, by benefiting society, you are also benefiting this individual. So that we said this already last week or the week before when we noted that all medicine is fundamentally flawed, meaning you're always unsure about what you're prescribed. And yet, we say you're obligated to pursue medical help. So there's an understanding that you're going to overlook risk for your own benefit, and that's actually a duty. Not only that, though, I'll give you another case in source number two. I'm a little bit torn because as I'm presenting this, I'm just rethinking it, and I'm not 100% sure that the source number two should be brought. I'm not sure that this is actually a good basis. The argument is you're allowed to expose someone to minimal harm in order to benefit them. All right, let me bring the source, and then you'll tell me why this may not be a good source. But let's see the case because it's a useful case. Source number two, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Krachmal, also known as Tzemach Tzedek. He deals with the question of liability for somebody who hires a worker, and the worker is harmed in the process of doing the work. Not where the employer was careless. The employer was not careless. Nonetheless, the employee got hurt in the course of doing the work. Is the employer in any way to be considered responsible? And Rabbi Krachmal makes the argument that you are not responsible. He says, why should the employer who hires a worker be liable? If he would be considered the cause, meaning just because you hired the guy, that makes you responsible, then no Jew should hire a Jewish worker, since it will be common for him to cause the death of his friend. He mentions Jewish not to exclude from non-Jew, but it fits in the context, the greater context of the responsum from which I took this. But he says, when you hire workers, look, Things happen on the job. You would now be responsible. But the first chapter of Pirkei Avot teaches paupers should be members of your household, and Maimonides, as well as Rabbi Ovadia Bar Tanura, explain that to mean that you should hire paupers to work in your home. You shouldn't have slaves, but rather you should hire people and give them a parnasa. You give them a living that way. So he says, I don't understand. How could our sages instruct people to hire somebody for a job, knowing that you could be creating a catastrophe for them? So the Tzemach Tzedek, Rabbi Krachmal, makes the argument that you are not responsible for what happens. Again, assuming you weren't careless, assuming you didn't send them into harm's way. But you're not responsible for hiring somebody who then gets hurt. If you were to be held responsible, then you wouldn't be allowed to hire other people. So the argument that I wanted to make, and the reason why I brought this, is this shows that you're able to expose somebody to minimal harm or minimal risk in order to help them, in order to benefit them. But why is this not a good proof? Why does this not prove my point?
Because, Rabbi, if somebody falls off their window cleaner, they fall off, they usually go after the owner of the building or the owner of the company as well.
Yes. But that's what I'm talking about here is the question from a Jewish law perspective. I'm not dealing with what's going to happen in the secular courts. He's making the argument.
The answer that in the case here, the individual doesn't have to take the job.
Right. That's why it's not the same. Right. Mark points out that the difference is that in that case, the person came to you for a job. You didn't compel them to work in your home. You made an offer. They said yes. Or maybe they even came to you and asked. We're talking about compulsion. So I think that it's not actually an appropriate basis. I think that doesn't prove the case. A stronger argument may be brought from a passage in the Talmud in source number 3. Passage here in number 3 is dealing with the case of people who are traveling on a boat. I feel like there should be a warning for everybody who lived in Talmudic times. Don't get on boats, because those stories never end well. Nonetheless, a man loaded a donkey on a boat before people entered the boat. It's like, you know, and they have like a horror movie, so don't go into the house, right? Don't go into the house at night. If you know you're in a horror movie, don't go into the house at night. So similarly, if you're in the Talmud, don't get on a boat. Well, man loaded a donkey on a boat before people entered the boat. The boat was starting to sink. One man pushed the donkey into the water, and it sank. So he saves the boat, he saves everybody else, by pushing the donkey overboard. So the donkey owner came to Rabba, sage from the time of the Talmud, who exempted the man. He says, you're not responsible for this man's donkey. You pushed it overboard to save everybody else. Abaye, who was the student of Rabba, challenged him. He said, no. That's called in Hebrew, matzil atzmo b'mamon chavero. You saved yourself with somebody else's property. Who entitled you to damage someone else's property to save your own skin? To which Rabba explained, it was a pursuer, word in Hebrew, rodef, from the start. The donkey, well, I shouldn't jump the gun. There's a major debate as to how to read that last line in the passage. Whether it's saying that the owner of the donkey was considered a rodef, a pursuer, by loading the donkey on the boat and the donkey's endangering everybody, the owner of the donkey is effectively responsible for the risk to everybody's lives. That's one way to take it. The other way to take it is that the donkey itself is the pursuer. Even though the donkey doesn't know what's going on, the donkey doesn't understand what's happening, nonetheless, you pose a risk to others, you are considered a rodef. You follow? Just by posing a risk. Sorry?
I think the owner of the boat is responsible.
We're not dealing with the owner of the boat. You're stuck on the insurance companies here. The question fundamentally is, the Talmud is saying, hang on, Sarah, I see your hand. What the Talmud here is suggesting is that it's okay that you push the donkey overboard? Because either the donkey's owner is a rodent for setting up that situation, is a pursuer, so therefore he can lose. Or the donkey itself is considered to be harming everybody else, endangering everybody else, even though it doesn't know that it's doing that. Sarah, what were you going to say?
When there is a situation of saving an animal or a person, isn't the person always in first place?
So that's if I am a third party, right? If I am a third party and the question is, I see somebody who's going to be harmed, and I can save him, but it's going to entail damage to somebody else's property, but I can save someone's life, so I have to save his life. But what we're dealing with here is you're saving yourself via somebody else's property, right? Questions like this come up all the time, right? This is the classic ethical dilemma, right? Heinz dilemma, right? You break into the pharmacy, right? Les Mis, you break into the supermarket for the bread, you break into the pharmacy for the medication, right? All of those circumstances, in order to save somebody who is vulnerable, you are going to take advantage of somebody else's property. And the question isn't really the question of, so do you save their life or not? But the question is, do you have to pay for what you took? Right? You have to pay for the damage that you created. excuse me, Sandy. Right, that was Marilyn's position. Marilyn said, hey, wait a minute, why did the boat owner let the donkey onto the boat in the first place? I'm not going more broadly here. I'm going to insulate the case from this by simply saying it's a case in which the boat could have supported normal donkeys. This donkey is an unusual donkey. What is unusual about it? It's a white donkey. I don't know. It's a white donkey in the Gemara, in the Talmud. A white donkey has an exceptionally hard bite. It's very dangerous. So I have no idea why, but this donkey was an unusual donkey. Myrna, you're muted. You have to unmute. Right.
So, on behalf of a person's self and other passengers who were going to get on the boat.
Fair point. Fair point. You could make the argument that it's not about saving himself, it's about saving others. That's a fair point. It seems that the way that it's framed here is the act of saving himself, perhaps because there's an understanding that he benefited personally by doing so. But I hear your point. I want to actually jump from this source, even though I think it's worth exploring that further and why they view it as saving himself. I'm going to jump a little bit to talk to a different contemporary discussion, one which you find in the Talmud and you still find today, which is the question of abortion when you have a fetus that is endangering the life of the mother. And I'm not dealing with the whole choice, that pro-life, pro-choice, I'm leaving that on the side. But can you view the fetus as being a rodef, a pursuer of the mother's health, even though the fetus doesn't know anything that's going on? It's not choosing to do it. It's like the donkey on the boat, right? So the question is, can you say that one is responsible for endangering others even if he's not trying to endanger others? And the reason why I mentioned that case, or the case of the donkey on the boat, either one, is because you can make the argument that society is able to compel people to vaccinate, to avoid endangering others, just like they're able to compel people not to load donkeys on boats. In other words, if you're going to tell me the donkey counts as a pursuer, and therefore, he shouldn't be on the boat in the first place. The same thing is true. This guy should not be endangering the community by refusing to vaccinate. And maybe on that basis, society should be able to compel vaccination. You see the argument? Sorry, what, Ian?
What about if the individual can't make that decision?
What do you mean?
Like somebody who's got significant cerebral palsy.
Right.
And they can't make a decision.
So.
Run the boat.
Right.
Or someone who can't talk. Or someone who can't hear.
Right. So then.
Or express themselves.
So this argument would say, it's okay. Society says it's not up to you. Society is going to demand vaccination, and it's not going to ask you. In other words, we're discussing here the question of compelling people. So even when they don't have the ability to make that choice, talk about minors, they don't have the ability to make that choice, society is going to make that choice on their behalf. That's what this would argue. Now, I would respond that this is not 100%, meaning it's relatively easy. I imagine it's easy. I've never made this calculation. But I imagine it's easy to say, okay, the boat is rated for this capacity, not that capacity. No donkeys on these boats. The boat is too flimsy to support the donkey. No donkey on the boat. However, the calculation with a vaccine that this individual who does not vaccinate is endangering society is a much harder calculation to make. Because we've said before, the vaccine is not necessarily 100% effective in the first place. So who's to say that vaccinating this person is actually going to do it? And there's a possibility at some point of herd immunity. If 90% of people are vaccinating, then maybe you do reach that point, and therefore they're not endangering the community. But that would be an argument for compulsory vaccination, would be you don't have the right to endanger the community.
But just a second, if a person believes that it's good for him, so isn't it written in the Bamitziah, Kodmim Lechayecha Vercha?
So that was Susan's source that she wanted to bring before, but that's not going to help the government to compel people, because that source only says, I can drink what I have. It doesn't say I can do violence to somebody else. That's the difference. So, but that's an argument you can make. So I tried to bring one argument for compelling to say you're allowed to expose people to risk in order to benefit them as you do when you hire somebody. But we said that doesn't work because that's optional for the other person. You're not compelling, as Mark pointed out. So I brought a second argument that maybe you can compel because they're endangering the community, like the donkey on the boat. However, not so clear cut. Because again, maybe they're not the one who tips the balance. Maybe they're not endangering society. And maybe you're not solving the problem by vaccinating them. But there's a third potential argument to justify society vaccinating people and saying it is compulsory. And that is social contract. You want to live within a society, you follow the rules that society creates for the good of the community. Right? The community's blood, to use a phrase that others have used, is redder than the blood of the individual. This is something that comes up in many ethical, challenging ethical situations. Example, unfortunately, comes up from time to time in Israel, where terrorists capture somebody, and they hold them, and they say, we're not releasing the terrorist unless you release a whole bunch of our friends who are in jail. People who have committed acts of terror before, people who are going to do it again if they get out. So the question then is, do you say that you're going to release do you say that you will release terrorists in order to save captive soldiers? Right? Are you willing to do that? Effectively, what you are doing is risking everybody's lives for the sake of the soldiers you are freeing. However, the reason for you to do that, the reason for you to take that risk and save the soldiers is the good of society as a whole. Take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi. Was asked this question about releasing terrorists in order to ransom captives. And he was dealing with the case where soldiers from the IDF had been taken captive, and he justified the prisoner exchange. He said, before the eyes of the determining authority, the one who resolved in government to do this, was an additional important point, the morale of the soldiers of the IDF. When a soldier knows that should he fall captive, the entire state of Israel would stand behind him to free him, he will risk his life in battle without fear. If you know that they're going to do it, then you will be okay going to war. So the idea is that it benefits society if they're willing to make this exchange. Ah, but you're now again taking a risk, and a known risk. You're releasing people who have committed murder and will do so again if they get the opportunity. You're taking a risk because you're saying this is for the good of society, it's social contract. I brought you source number 5, Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli, a leading rabbi in Israel in the middle of the 20th century, who made the argument as well, in favor of such deals. So maybe the answer really is that Jewish law will say, take that risk in order to benefit society. As a matter of practical law in Judaism, as practical halacha, we tend not to coerce people to take risks for the sake of society. We don't do it. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach dealt with this question regarding compelling people to engage in medical trials. We'll talk about him when we talk about about vaccine trials. Was not willing to say that government should be able to coerce people to take a risk. And I think there are a couple of reasons why we wouldn't do it. We've already noted one reason not to do it, and that was the issue in our case of effectiveness, and maybe the vaccine won't be effective anyway. But I think that it's deeper than that, and I see your hand, Mark, but I'm going to go a little further first. I think it's a deeper point about the way Judaism looks at, so to speak, the rights of the person and the body of the person. Question came up in the Middle Ages repeatedly in Jewish law. The question was asked, what if there is some powerful person, perhaps somebody in government, who has captured a Jew and is holding him hostage and says, I'm going to execute him. However, in the event that you allow me to wound you, cut off a body part of yours, I'll free him. This is a cruel person. Says, I won't kill this guy if you will allow me to wound you. Do you have a duty to allow him to maim you, to take off a body part in order to save the other guy? Whether this question was hypothetical, philosophical, or whether this question was practical has been debated. Jews have been in enough situations where it really could have been practical. There certainly are plenty of Holocaust stories involving situations like this. And the question is, what do you do? Well, back in the 16th century, Rabbi David ben Shlomo ibn Avi Zimra, the Radbaz, dealt with this question. He wasn't the first, but what his response on it is widely quoted. And he says, it would be a pious trait for a person to do that. It would be pious to do it. But he says it's not obligatory. And one of his reasons for saying it's not obligatory is, it is written, Tanakh says, Derecheha Derchei Noam, her ways, the ways of the Torah, are ways of pleasantness. And the laws of our Torah must fit intellect and logic. How could we think that one would let someone blind his eye or cut off his hand or foot so that he wouldn't kill somebody else? He says that doesn't make any sense, that someone should have to surrender that to that. I see no reason for this law other than a pious trait. It may be wonderfully pious for you to surrender a limb in order to save somebody else's life, but he says it's not obligatory. And if it may be fatal to do that, right? 16th century, they're doing it without anesthesia, they're doing it without antiseptic. He says, this is a pious fool, for his doubt overrides the other's certainty. The possibility that he could be harmed in this way overrides the certainty of the other guy. So the position that Radbaz, Rabbi David ben Shlomo, Ibn Abi Zimra takes is, it's not sensible to coerce it. And I think you can make that argument, granted that having a vaccine does not pose the level of risk of having a body part removed in the 16th century, nonetheless, you can make the argument that it's something that society cannot accept, that we would force that kind of risk on somebody. Mark, you were going to ask?
Back when governments were instituting mandatory seatbelt legislation, people were able to provide some anecdotal evidence that in certain kinds of accidents, it could be more hazardous to wear a seatbelt. But they said for the greater good, we are going to say everybody must.
Right. But what's the big difference between the seatbelt case and our case?
We harm to others? Repercussions to other people? Or when you, I don't know what you're...
Well, I think that the major difference between them would be the percentage of... I don't know, percentage is the wrong word. The proportion of... I'll say it differently. I'm not coming up with the right words. You're doing more to save yourself in the seatbelt case, proportionate to the risk you are taking, than in the vaccine case. You can make a stronger argument of, I am likely to never get this illness, compared to the potential risk of the vaccine, than you can make for, I am never going to be in an accident, but if I am in an accident, it's likely that it'll be an accident where a seatbelt would be harmful. You know what I'm saying? Like the proportions are different. Ian, what were you going to say?
What about interrogation?
What about it?
In the armed forces, a general principle is they interrogate prisoners of war.
Right.
So are you saying that halachically interrogation is a no-no?
Well, you don't mean interrogation, right? Because we're not talking about asking people questions here. We're talking about sticking a needle in their arm.
Hypothetical.
You're talking about torture.
Well, not necessarily. Well, in a way, it's torture. I'll let your pal live if I could chop off your hand. Or I'll chop off a finger.
So that is an excellent ethical question in its own right. It's also a practical question, because I think studies have shown that people who are questioned in that way tend not to give useful information. They for obvious reasons. They'll tell you whatever you want to hear, and you're desperate to hear stuff from them. And it tends not to be so effective. You're also not dealing there with a government and society question. You're dealing with a hostile situation altogether. This was an enemy soldier who came to attack you. You're not dealing with a citizen of your country. I think there are a lot of different parameters that are different. So I'm going to beg off of that case. But what we're trying to say here is, can the government compel its citizens to take a risk in order to harm others, in order to save others, I should say, arguing that if they're not willing to take that risk, they are endangering society, and arguing that social contract says, take these risks in order to be able to help others. And what we're saying is that we generally would not coerce. That's the way that the halachic rulings on this seem to go. Government would not coerce, perhaps because it's simply not acceptable to think that we would force people to enter into harm in order to save others. I brought you a passage, which is the passage that Mark asked about before from the Jerusalem Talmud in source number 7, but I'm actually going to skip it. I apologize, Mark. The passage there talks about where you're surrounded by bandits and they're threatening, and can you turn over one person in order to save everybody else? And I'll just tell you that the source says that unless they specify one particular person, generally speaking, we will not turn over one person in order to save everybody else. You can't compel a person to be the one to surrender their life. There are nuances in the case, and I'm not going into it because I don't want to get into the nuances that it raises, or we won't get anywhere else. But that's, this is all from the government's perspective. I see, Susan, I see your hand. Is it short or long? Short, okay.
I just want to know if we flip it. So that, like what happened with the measles case, where that mother didn't vaccinate her kid. The kid, the stewardess got the measles and died. So if we flip it on its head and say, yeah, but you didn't vaccinate because you had the right individuality. But on the other hand, someone died. So it's flipped, it's saying, so that, isn't that just as wrong?
So that's the thing. That's where we're going now. So thank you for the segue. I was talking about it from the government's perspective in terms of compelling. But now I want to talk about the other half of it, which is from the patient's perspective, is there a duty? Even if government can't force me, do I have a duty anyway? Where I don't think that I need this vaccine for my own safety, nonetheless, do I have a duty to do it in order to benefit and protect other people? That's the question at hand. And what we said already last time is we have biblical models for people taking on risk in order to save others. We mentioned Esther in the Purim story. We mentioned Avram going to war to save his brother-in-law Lot. But we said it's hard to use biblical examples as a basis because often they're working with the assumption and even the knowledge that God is going to save them. Some leaving biblical cases out. A more substantive source that we can use is source number 8. Passage in the Talmud, which we've seen before. How do you know that somebody who sees somebody else drowning in a river, being dragged by a beast, being beset by bandits, has to act to save him? The Torah says, don't stand by while others' blood is shed. But there's some risk involved in jumping into the river. There's some risk involved in saving someone from bandits or from wild animals. Clearly, there is some expectation that you are going to take risk in order to help somebody else. That's one basis for saying that even if government can't compel it, it's still an obligation for the individual. Another basis for it is an institution called war. You're familiar with war? Right. Take a look at source number 9. In Judaism, there are times when there is an obligation to go to war. The nation is attacked. You have a responsibility. So Rabbi Yosef Abad, writing in Minchat Chinuch, asks a question. He says, I don't understand. We say that saving lives overrides almost everything. How can you obligate a soldier to go to war? He's endangering his life in order to help the community, but he has an obligation to save his life. How can you obligate the soldier to go to war? So he says in number 9, granted that all mitzvot are overridden in the face of danger, still, the Torah instructed us to do battle for this mitzvah. In those circumstances where the Torah mandates going to war, that's the obligation. It is known that the Torah will not depend on miracles. The Torah is not assuming that all the soldiers are going to survive, as explained by Ramban. It is normal. No, Ruchama Rak Shnia. It is normal for people to be killed on both sides in a war, that should say war, not way, spell check missed that. And so we see that the Torah decrees to do battle despite the danger. In other words, the fact that the Torah legislates going to war is not because it's assuming you're going to be okay. It knows there's a risk. Nonetheless, the concern for danger is overridden in this case. That's the response, is you may have a duty to do something. Ruchama, what were you saying?
There is a milchemet chova.
Nachon.
And milchemet mitzvah. Those two milchemot, mitzvah and chova, have the reasons for them, and we have to do it.
Yes, but the point is that you're overriding pikuach nefesh. You're overriding concern for your own life. So we see that there is a responsibility on the individual to do this. Further, even if the individual says, I don't think I need it, nonetheless, the individual does benefit at the end of the day because the community benefits. Rabbi Cook, in source number 10, made that point regarding war. He said, don't extrapolate from war to most other circumstances. You can't extrapolate from war to most other circumstances. Why? Because matters of the community and of war don't come under the rubric of you shall live by them. War and the laws of the community are unique. Meaning when we say your life comes first before most mitzvot, he says that's a different story. War is not the same as everything else. You benefit from it. And the same thing could be argued here. You benefit when the community benefits, when people are vaccinated. So for all these reasons, there may indeed be a responsibility for the individual to vaccinate himself, even if he feels like he doesn't need it personally. Clear? We understand what we're saying? Because of the fact that we say, look, you have to endanger yourself to save others, clearly there is such a concept. That was in source number 8. Number 2, because we see the model of war. And number 3, because this is a case of benefiting the community as a whole, therefore you benefit as well. Nonetheless, the rulings that we find in Jewish law tend to stop short of compelling. We do say that one should enter into a low risk in order to save the life of another person. That we do in general say. I brought you a passage in source number 11. By the interest of time, I'm just going to explain it outside of the text. They're dealing with a question in which there are two towns on a river. One is upriver, one is downriver. So the one upriver controls the water. If they use the water for themselves, the one downriver is not getting the water. So the question becomes, what if the people who live at the top of the river want to use the water to do their laundry? And the people at the bottom of the river want to use it as drinking water. Are the people upriver allowed to use it for their laundry? Knowing that means the people downriver are either going to have to move or die. So the sages say in this discussion that you have to let the people downriver get the water. You can't use it for your laundry. You have to leave it to them. The Rabbi Yossi's position is a different position and is for discussion another time. The point is that you have to be willing to sacrifice your laundry, even though laundry matters. You don't want to see a city that goes without laundry for any period of time. That has all sorts of other health effects on the city as a whole. Nonetheless, when people need the water to drink, you take that risk. This question has a very, very practical application on a day-to-day basis. The issue of organ donation. Right? I'm not talking now about taking organs from someone who has already passed away. That's a whole other discussion. I'm talking about live organ donation. For a person to donate a kidney. Right? For a person to give blood. How do we view live organ donation? So in fact, halachic authorities do tend to assume if the danger is very small, you have a duty to take it on. So Rabbi Asher Weiss said, if you take a look at source number 12, a leading authority in Israel today says, regarding kidney donation, if I did not fear my peers who disagree with me, my heart would be inclined to say that today it is entirely obligatory. For all studies show that the danger to the donor is very low, almost non-existent, and the possibility of saving a life is very great. Now, the truth of the matter is that I've seen studies that argue that long-term, there may well be levels of risk. You can shorten the life of the donor long term. I wouldn't discount it. There's research that's still coming out now from long term studies of kidney donors. But nonetheless, I bring this to show you the strength of the position that says even if government can't compel, the individual has a duty to do so. Source number 13, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, who is a leading physician in Israel. He is a pediatric neurologist, I believe. Dr. Kirshen, correct me if he's a neurosurgeon, but I think he's a neurologist. As well as a major authority in Jewish law in Israel today, He writes in number 13, a live person may donate a kidney from his body to a patient who suffers from end-stage renal insufficiency. This is a pious trait and the mitzvah of saving a life, but one is not obligated to do this. We tend not to obligate. We go back to what Susan pointed out in the beginning. It's source number 14, that your life comes first, and you're able to say, I'm not willing to do it. We stop short of saying that Jewish law will make it a firm requirement, although, if you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Dr. Akiva Tatz, the South Africans know him, I believe, quotes Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv, who was a major authority in Jewish law until he passed away several years ago. He says, in fact, Rabbi Al-Yashiv went so far as to assert that failure to immunize would amount to negligence. Refusing childhood immunizations on the basis of unsubstantiated fears of vaccine side effects is irresponsible and out of order halachically. He was very strong. But in general, the approach is to say government does not have the ability to compel, even though we have the argument that the non-vaccinated person is pursuing others and is a danger to them, and the argument of social contract, we stop short of saying government compels, much as in Canada, in fact, the government does not compel. From the patient's perspective, it's a strong argument that one really ought to vaccinate oneself. Most authorities, though, stop short, assuming that there is a significant risk involved. As the risk drops, you get positions like Rav Asher Weiss and Rabbi Eliashiv saying there's no excuse, and then you will have an obligation to do so. As the risk drops, the obligation rises for the individual. Last, I want to talk about two niche cases, and I'm going to stop taking questions at this point because we have 8 minutes to go, and I want to make sure to discuss these two niche cases. Schools and healthcare settings, special cases. As we saw before, some halachic authorities argue that a school is not able to exclude children who are unvaccinated, right? We saw that in a letter in the sources, I think, last week. However, there are authorities in Jewish law who disagree and say no. A Jewish school is entitled to exclude students even if the parents are not obligated to vaccinate them, fine, but the school is able to exclude those students. On what basis? Take a look at source number 16 from Rabbi J. David Bleich. He says, a person is certainly under no obligation to allow others to pose harm to him or to his children. You don't have to accept that. He says, a person is under no obligation to allow others to pose harm to him or to his children. This is talking about the other parents in the school who say, well, if your kid isn't going to vaccinate, then I don't want your kid to be with my kid in school. He says, schools have always excluded people. In days gone by, a teacher accepted students for tutelage, exercising discretion in choosing his charges in the manner of any other artisan or professional, right? If you were a Rebbe, if you were a Melamed in some town in Europe, you know, go back 500 years, you didn't just say, I'm going to teach whoever wants me to teach them. You charge tuition, and then you would teach the kid. But you were able to exclude. Alternatively, a group of parents cooperatively engaged the teacher to provide instruction for their children. Such arrangements were entirely at the discretion of the parents and the teachers. Presently, for better or for worse, entire schools are established in much the same manner by a single educator or by a group of administrators. They make decisions. Communal institutions must be concerned with the educational welfare of all children in the community. Yet even such institutions dare not sacrifice the many for the sake of the few. Quite to the contrary, their mandate is to maximize educational opportunities by safeguarding the health and welfare of all prospective students. So his argument is that the school has to worry about the welfare of all the students, and it's able to make the decision to exclude. Sometimes schools exclude based on ability to pay. Whether we like it or not, it happens. Sometimes schools will exclude students because they say we can't provide for that student's educational needs. Whether we like it or not, that's a reality. And sometimes, he says, the school will say, this student is a threat to the health of the other students, and therefore the school will exclude this student. That's the argument. So that's in terms of school children, and there's more to be said about this. I just didn't, you know, I knew we wouldn't have time to do additional sources, but there's more that could be brought supporting this. What about healthcare workers? Can you make the argument that healthcare workers are obligated to vaccinate? So, in other words, because of the need to protect their patients. So this came up, obviously, in other epidemics, pandemics. It came up in SARS, the obligation to go to work, knowing that you're exposed. There's a lot to talk about in terms of healthcare obligations. But fundamentally, from a Jewish law perspective, healthcare workers are obligated to treat. They have a duty to look after the health of the community. And that's something we've seen before. We said, we brought the passage from the Code of Jewish Law, Yeredei Shin Lamed Vav, says that in the event that you have the capacity to heal and you don't, that's murder. That's bloodshed. However, the healthcare professional is entitled to a level of protection. And I want to make sure to note that. If you take a look at source number 17, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg talks about this. He talks about treating patients in a time of an epidemic. And he says the doctor is entitled to a level of protection such that they don't have to deal with a high risk. He has to treat contagious patients, but he has to be protected in whatever way is considered normal to protect. That's a basic point. But now let's take that further. You're telling me that there's an obligation to treat patients. Well, what if treating patients includes getting a vaccination so that you don't cause the patients harm? Is that indeed your responsibility? And the answer seems to be yes. That's considered to be part of taking care of the patients. We have literature going back to the 19th century, probably earlier, but the one that I'm familiar with is the 19th century, about doctors treating patients during epidemics and being required to quarantine within the Jewish community. They still went on and treated. This is something that you have to put up with as part of taking care of the patient. Last point within this, and then we'll do a fast summary. Source number 18, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, a Rebbe of mine, has said that in the event that the state does mandate vaccination, that becomes an obligation under a completely separate set of rules that we haven't discussed at all, called Dina Demalchuta Dina. The law of the land is the law. Meaning that in Judaism we are taught that in the event that that the government makes legislation for the benefit of the nation, there's a duty for each citizen to observe that legislation, so long as it is not legislation that will force people to violate the Torah. In other words, if the government says you must eat ham sandwiches on Wednesday, we have no obligation to follow the government's legislation. However, vaccination is not against Jewish law. So therefore, if we take a look at source number 18, Rav Herschel Schachter also asserted that where vaccines are mandated by the state, such as in the case of immunizations before entering school, he's not dealing with the Canadian issue, one will be obligated to be immunized based on the concept of Dina Demalchuta Dina, the law of the land is the law. So that's a separate point, which again doesn't pertain if the government is not requiring it, but it's something that is definitely something to be aware of. So to sum up what we said today, and then I'll stick around for 10 minutes or so for questions and comments, but what we said was this: the government of Canada does not absolutely require vaccination, although two provinces allow school boards to say you have to be vaccinated to enter school unless you have a medical exemption, unless you have an ideological exemption, which amounts to saying it's not obligatory. We said that the government, from a Jewish law perspective, the argument could be that government could require it on the basis of saying that the unvaccinated person is endangering the community like the donkey on the boat. on the basis of the argument that social contract accepts that individuals have to take risks for the sake of the community, just as we free terrorists in order to save soldiers. However, as a matter of Jewish law, we don't coerce. Perhaps because it's considered inappropriate, just like the case of cutting off a body part in order to save somebody else's life, we consider it inappropriate to mandate that. That's all one issue, the government's perspective. What about the patient's perspective? So from the patient's perspective, you can make the argument that there's an obligation to take on this risk to help others. Like the Gemara says, you have an obligation to save people from harm, even though the saving them may involve a level of risk. Just like also the soldier goes to war, even though war involves a level of risk. And because of the fact that when society benefits, you benefit as well. Some authorities indeed will obligate you to enter into a very low level of risk in order to help others, and they may apply that to vaccination. But most authorities stop short of compelling and say, fundamentally, your life comes before that of others, as well as the argument that we made before, Durachah Hadarchi Noam, the ways of the Torah are pleasant, and we don't want to force you to do this. Last, we had two niche cases, the school children case, and we said that a school could exclude children who refuse whose parents are not vaccinating them. And in terms of healthcare workers who have a duty to treat, if part of that duty requires that they vaccinate themselves, then indeed that price should be paid. And then the last note was, if the law of the land becomes vaccination, then it seems that, as Rav Herschel Schachter says, that triggers an obligation for everybody to vaccinate, because the law of the land is the law. There's a lot more to be said about all of this. I refer you back to the links I've given before to other vaccine-related classes of mine. But God willing, next week we're going to talk challenge trials, and we'll talk about vaccine distribution. We'll try to get something of substance in on both of them. Thank you very, very much. And I'll stick around for questions now.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Shkoyach to you. Questions and comments? Ben, I saw your note. Hi, Etty? Yeah.